Mate, we got John Cummins doing about 20 to 30 minutes on a so-called new normal. Right, take it away, John. Thank you, John.
Right, thanks. Good evening, comrades and fellow workers. This phrase, the new normal, is one that's only really come to my attention during the current crisis. According to Wikipedia, it's not a new phrase. It's a new normal is a state to which an economy, society, etc. settles following a crisis when this differs from the situation that prevailed before the start of the crisis. Well, so far that's just a neutral sounding, fairly descriptive term. But they do go on to state that the term has been used in relation to the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 and the aftermath of the 2008 to 2012 Great Recession or Global Recession. And of course, now to the COVID-19 pandemia or pandemic, depending on what you want to call it. But despite this etymology, the expression seems to have gained more widespread usage during the present crisis. I'd certainly never heard it much used before. Perhaps it was just boring political type people that used the expression, but not our kind of politics. But regardless of how new or old the phrase itself is, the concept, of course, is far from new to us. In our lives, we're faced with many changes which could be said to establish new normals over and over again. The expression can actually have disquieting connotations, since what is normal is usually considered to be good, and so abnormal is considered to be bad. So until about the age of 5, even for those destined for a life of wage slavery, life is often quite pleasant. After all, just about everything's new, and you're learning new things every day. It's perhaps the most exciting time in your life, but you sadly don't remember much of it. Tends to be the miserable things that come later on that you remember. Then a new normal, of course, is established, and this is quite a traumatic one. You're press-ganged into an establishment called school, where you'll be trained or schooled in preparation for what will be required of you as a wage slave. And there you're taught how to become obsessed by things like attendance, punctuality, and of course conformity. And above all, to obey. To basically be a dumb and docile wage slave. Almost nothing like an education can be obtained in these places. Schooling for a subservient role in class-divided society is what goes on there. Someone browbeating you into literacy or what passes for it. Of course, the owner's children go to their own special private schools, which can also be traumatic for them. Not that we're that worried about that. Where they're taught how to rule, but not necessarily educated either, as I'm sure you can think of many examples of members of the ruling class or their apologists who go to private schools, or rather expensively schooled, but don't seem to have picked up much of an education, despite all the opportunities they've had. Anyway, once you've completed your schooling, if you are a member of the working class, you're ready to go to work. Perhaps oven ready, as one bumptious owner might say. If you're a member of the capitalist class, you're of course not available for employment. So I would suggest you try this as a wage slave and see how far you get. So this is a new normal that's developing for the young wage slave or potential wage slave. The young ruling class person can obviously look after themselves. In either case, anyway, a new normal is established for you. The various changes to which the young wage slave will be subjected will be more or less traumatic, depending generally upon whether he or she is destined to become factory shop, call centre or office fodder. In fact, even if you're quite highly trained in some of the so-called professions, the new normal for you will soon become quite tedious. Capitalism has got an unhappy knack of ruining even the most interesting kind of work. As a wage slave, you will have to get used to this new normal. What will happen to you is that perhaps for the next 50 years or so, the life will be more or less judiciously sucked out of you, depending upon the degree of skill your labour power represents. If the skills you are able to sell are quite cheap, you'll often have orders barked at you and be driven on under sweatshop conditions to the point of injury, ill health and premature death. But if your skills are not so cheap, you may be asked to do certain things, but you'll soon realise that these apparently polite requests are not optional. The requests or wishes are your commands under this absurd etiquette of wage slavery. Every change to your working conditions proposed and imposed by management will be presented as something positive and good. Challenges and opportunities, or as the ex-Prime Minister David Cameron said, turning challenges into opportunities. These people just don't know when they've gone too far. So even though every worker knows from experience, or certainly should know, if they've been around long enough, that almost every such change will be detrimental to your interests, another new normal. In a bid to wheedle, cajole and coerce, you will be told that the status quo is not an option, which must be one of the most stupid things employers say. Yet a coercive apparatus exists to preserve, protect and defend the continued existence of capitalism, that is to say, the status quo, another one of the mad contradictions in capitalism. So this will be normal for you until the hour of your death or retirement. But let's not dwell too much on all that employment-related misery. Let's look instead at some of the other misery, like other pandemics. In 1348, the Black Death, as it was later called, which was a bubonic plague pandemic, reached England in the middle of that year. I forgot whether I said 1348. Anyway, it arrived in the middle of 1348. So perhaps about 40%, some say many more, of the population of Europe died as a result of this disease. Another result was that many peasants, artisans and others who survived it found themselves in a better economic position than before. This circumstance intensified the class struggle during the ensuing years, and many peasants' revolts occurred throughout Europe. There's a well-known Jacqueries in France, and the one probably best known to us is the English Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Then there was the so-called Spanish flu of 1918 in the aftermath of World War I. This seemed to be facilitated by mass troop movements, along with the displacement of people by the war. And that's what really enabled that pandemic to take hold. And it seems to have been, from what they say, the most deadly outbreak of influenza in history. And it managed to spread and kill more people than had already died in the war immediately preceding it. In its aftermath, there doesn't seem to have been, in fact, there's no discernible economic benefit derived by the majority of survivors. But 8 years later, there was the general strike. So there's maybe an indication of some of the effects, either relatively short-term or long-term, of these crises that occur from time to time. With the peasants, it took about 32 years after the Black Death, I suppose, for these things to work their way through the system. But the collective memory must have learned something from their circumstances and decided to act. Unfortunately, they weren't in a position to, at that time, overthrow the existing society. But nevertheless, it seems to have had a long-term effect, although immediately, as we know, immediately after the revolt, it was put down by the little king, of course, who they thought might be their friend. This is a common theme throughout history, but we're not. We would be digressing if we start to discuss that here. So as I say, the aftermath of the pandemic of 100 years ago, there was no economic benefit derived by the majority of survivors. It didn't seem to lead to anything other than more economic depression and, of course, as a reaction to that, the general strike. So we now come to the current crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic. And in the synopsis, you might have seen in the Standard, I referred to a programme that was on the radio. It was on instead of Start the Week in June. And it's a programme called Rethink. And it asked, how has the coronavirus pandemic created an opportunity to reshape our world? And I get quite irritated when TV people ask, or TV and radio people, media capitalist media people, ask these sort of questions. They talk about reshaping our world, well, and they're asking, how has the pandemic created an opportunity, one of their beloved words, to reshape our world? Well, has it really, and will it? Or is it just going to be that this phrase will become just another irritating buzzword in our master's lexicon of stupid phrases? They mention our world in a similar way to how they talk about our country, our streets, our hospitals, our prisons even. And I really find this kind of talk rather irritating. Just like the announcements they make at the supermarket, your Asda store will be closing in 15 minutes. Well, to use a phrase that's currently in circulation, words do matter. But I digress yet again. On that programme to which I referred there, were Tony Blair, George Osborne, Michelle Bachelet, the former President of Chile, and Kevin Rudd, who used to be Australian Prime Minister. So from that little coterie, I think we could be fairly sure that any reshaping they had in mind was going to be severely limited. And of course, surprise, surprise, it was. At the start of the programme, a student suggested that leaders should have empathy and compassion. And this silly, if well-meaning notion must have been too radical for a Monday morning. And so she was not heard from again. The best Osborne could come up with was that if this pandemic had happened in earlier times, it would have been much worse. Well, don't think that was that hard to work out. Rudd suggested that income distribution should be made better. Better for whom, we might ask? Sorry about the interruption here. I saw a message coming in through Discord. It wasn't saying that I can't be heard. So hopefully everything's okay. So I'll continue. Yes, the best that Osborne could come up with was if this pandemic had happened in earlier times, it would have been much worse. Well, surprise, surprise. Rudd suggested that economic distribution should be made better, whatever that means. Better for whom, we might ask. There was a talk of a more equal society, which always comes up when we've got an economic crisis, and that's what we're about to have in following this pandemic. So there was talk of a more equal society, an economy which should be more inclusive, which is another one of the buzzwords they like to use nowadays, with improved participation, yet another buzzword. So that must have been quite a strain in the brains of these clever, clever people. The presenter, however, Amal Rajan, suggested that capitalism may need to become more effective at spreading ownership, and he sort of mused that could governments throughout the world get together and say that too much wealth is going to too few? That too much wealth going to too few is wrong. Well, I think we all know the answer to that one, but that might be an interesting point of discussion later on. There has been a number of these programmes produced as podcasts on this theme since then, and I had hoped that perhaps the odd serious contributor might have been heard, but if they were, I didn't hear them. But I didn't get to hear as many of these podcasts as I would have liked, so I did hear bits and pieces here and there, and some of it did sound quite good as a criticism of capitalism. But as usual, we didn't get anything that was more in line with our way of thinking. So, as I say, here and there, you'll hear some good descriptions of what's wrong with capitalism, even some utopian schemes to eliminate some of the problems in capitalism. But we know that these wouldn't work if you leave capitalism intact. Certain problems are just insoluble so long as capitalism lasts. But there was one person on the Rethink series, an American called Anand Giridharadas, and he did a talk on rethinking capitalism just maybe about a week or so after the first programme that I heard. And he asks if now is the moment to rethink everything. So that sounds kind of promising. Perhaps this pandemic, he says, has allowed us to see the future more clearly. There is a number of crises existing simultaneously. And he says these are employment, racism, climate crisis, and democratic crisis. And he cites the example being a mad demagogue in the White House. He said they are distinct but intersecting crises. Well, they may be distinct to some of the people that are only affected by one or other or of these crises that he identifies, but I think we would argue that these crises are just another example of the kind of what would you call it, the symptoms of capitalism. So he says that the experience of these crises that are, as he says, are distinct but intersecting. He says, but they make plain that, and I'm quoting him here, he says, we will either transform our way of life or we will decline and fall as Americans and possibly as a species. Going back to normal is impossible. It is plain as day now that the capitalism we were practicing would soon have destroyed us. It is plain that a society which is built upon extraction from the planet will eventually extract us too. Another way of life, another social order, another way of relating to each other, another way of living with and on our planet, another way of judging what matters. These things glimmer on the horizon. With 2020 foresight, let us march toward these things. So that sounds all quite promising, but it's not really specific enough, and it's on the horizon, as is quite often the case with these things. But nevertheless, this guy elsewhere, he says that it's immoral to be a billionaire, and he does show quite a good understanding of how capitalism works. But the morality argument, as we know, is not the best one to really be used against capitalism. I know someone from my workplace, that place that I no longer have to actually attend, who expresses a similar view, which rather infuriates me, because he almost refuses to accept that much can change, not only now, but actually ever. So at least this Anand Giridharadas is a bit more optimistic than that and has identified real serious problems with capitalism and hopes that as a society we can do something about it, although so far I perhaps just hadn't heard enough of his broadcasts. I haven't heard the kind of detail that I would like to hear. But he has said some other things which you might be interested to hear. He called Trump a semi-literate racist prick. And then other things that he said shortly after that were, we are absolutely not all in it together. Maybe we will be able to build a new society. And that sounds like the kind of phrases that we would use, but we would like more detail about what that new society would be. So, yes, maybe we will be able to build a new society, but will it be as a result of any rethinking that was done during this crisis? Well, at this point, I would ask you, comrades and fellow workers, what do you think? Thank you.
Right. First to kick off then is Steve. Thank you, Steve. Your question, please.
Thanks, comrade. Thanks, John, for your speech. Just one thing that struck me as you were talking is this this idea about we being promised a more participative economy. Do you think that means that we're going to have to work longer before we get any pensions? Now that we were, well, most of us now are working until we're 67. Do you think we're going to have to work even longer? Do you think that's what they meant?
Yes, I actually do think that's what they meant, because I actually, on one of these Rethink programmes, they were talking about rethinking work, and that's one of the things that came up. from one of these capitalist supporting characters that was on it. So, yes, I definitely, that's long since been on their agenda. That's something that we can definitely have to, look forward to, but not in a good way.
Okay, thanks.
Right, thank you for that, John. Right, Howard Moss next, please. Thank you, Howard.
Thanks very much, John. I just wanted to say that among these Rethink programmes, there was one where they invited listeners to send in contributions, and some of them were actually put on the programme, including actually one of our comrades, Joy, and she was able to read out her contribution. The trouble is they chopped part of it off. So, okay, the part she read out was fine, but the most relevant part from the point of view of our case was chopped off. So, unfortunately, although we got in on that, we only did in a sort of limited way. And I must say, generally speaking, these programs have been, I found them pretty pathetic, I must say, because, you know, the rethinking has been so unbelievably limited, so within the confines, within the framework of the system, that, okay, it's refreshing when you get an individual like the one you talked about, sort of, you know, possibly managing to look outside this. But that kind of thing has really been swamped, by things like, we need more equality. What does that mean? Heaven knows. We need more diversity, et cetera, or, you know, even sort more sport in school and that kind of thing. This is the kind of thing these programs have been about largely. Disappointing, you know, still an opportunity maybe. They're still going for party members to actually somehow get in on this series.
Yes, that's good to hear that there was some good. I did hear snippets here and there. There was one, I thought it was this week, but I think it must have been actually last week that they were on, and there was one on health matters, rethinking health, and it seemed not too bad in the sense of there seemed to be a better understanding displayed of how many of these health problems were really wider social problems that resulted from poverty and very extreme poverty, and how all of these problems were interrelated. But again, it didn't really suggest any solution, no sort of attempt to suggest perhaps the sacred system might somehow be to blame.
Right, thank you there, John. Right, next is Raymond. Raymond, over to you.
Right, cheers. Thank you, John. It is frustrating, as Howard Moss said, how limiting these discussions are always. And then you've got these people like Slavoj Žižek and Richard Wolff and all these guys who are, you know, getting paid to fly over the world talking shite. But I think it is so limiting because, you know, the vast majority of these pundits and so-called experts, I've got a very, very loose, very, they've not even got a grasp of what capitalism means. They know we're living in a social system, but in a way they don't. It's a weird kind of dichotomy. And I would even say that certain members of the capitalist class probably don't even know. It's just always what's been. It's just life. It's just society. They can't, it's like, you know, goldfish swimming about in a goldfish bowl. They don't know they're underwater. They don't know they're in the water until you take them out. But the other thing I wanted to ask you, John, was did you think about maybe emailing that Anand guy? Because this is the world we're living in. You can, somebody that you hear on a radio program, you know, within a day, you can be talking to them on something like this or send them an email. Cheers.
I must admit, I hadn't even thought of that. Occasionally, I've thought of contacting some people that I hear, but I'm probably quite conditioned by the pre-internet years to assume that people that get widespread broadcast of their views are not usually available for discussion. But yeah, that's an interesting idea. Just on the subject of this Grady Haridas guy, another thing that he said was that he's actually interviewed a lot of billionaires and he's spoken to them as well as that off the record. And he says that quite a number of them actually agree. This is a thing I've long suspected and wondered about. That a lot of them actually agree with him that, I mean, they're putting it in moral terms, but he's made it clear that apart from the what he calls the immorality of it, he does understand how the society works and how it works to the advantage of the billionaires and how they order things in such a way as to further their advantageous position. But the crucial thing that I was going to mention there was that he says that quite a number of those billionaires agree that they're actually, as he calls it, immoral and quite useless, socially useless. So that's a thing that I'd long suspected, that any intelligent person in that position must surely realise that in actual fact they perform no function in society except to own, and you can hardly call that a function. So that was another interesting thing that came up.
Some enlightened capitalists, maybe. Just in terms of sometimes, I mean, I don't watch this game show, Newsnight, it's Question Time, but on occasion, you know, you'll see a panel of all these fucking arseholes, or as I say, Slavoj Žižek or something, and I just often wish there was a party member there because they'd fucking, whoever it was, they'd fucking wipe the flare with them. Cheers.
Yes, I stopped listening to a lot of these so-called debating programmes, particularly that Question Time one. I do listen to the one on the radio, but I find it quite annoying because the assumption behind these things is that we've got four or five people on this panel, and therefore if you ask them your question and they give you an answer, each one in turn gives you an answer of some sort, that's you. You've covered the whole range of possible opinions that you can have. And, you know, to me, it's just jollying people along. And they'll encourage people to phone in to these programmes or join the audience and have your say. And I think, oh, so what? And then what? You know, because the then what is the thing that matters. Having your say is all very well. But as we know, many people in power and even in petty authority have been taught how to pretend to listen, to seem to listen, and then just ignore what you've said and carry on, because the truth is that the system doesn't really permit them to really attend to your concerns.
Aye, totally. Before I finish, another blowhard that I can think of is Chomsky. Who's another one of these people that never goes far enough. But there is one good thing he said, insofar as he said that a very rigorous amount of debate is allowed, but within a very, very narrow framework to make it look as if, you know, the topics being discussed are being thrashed out. But of course, to our eyes, of course, they're no. Cheers.
Yes, I think that's particularly true, particularly in kind of academia where he works or where he originated from. It does seem that it's built in that you can talk and never come to any conclusion seems to be the main thing. This is particularly the case in the discussions they had about war 6 years ago when they were celebrating the British capitalist class's victory over the German capitalist class. They were talking about the 1914 to 18 war, and one of the things that they said was that historians are still baffled over what was the cause of it. They're still arguing over it. Well, they are arguing over some sensible historians should be, as ever, arguing over particular details as new facts come to light. But the basic cause of the war was pretty much known by almost everybody that was paying attention at the time. So it's quite ridiculous to say that, but it suits their purpose for a variety of reasons to perpetuate this notion that, oh, it's too hard to understand. But we clever people, we'll keep discussing it, you know.
Right. Next in line is Mike Foster. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, John. Yeah, it was a very interesting talk. Yeah, you gave us a lot to think about. I enjoyed that. And the angle I was thinking about from what you were saying was, like we've just been saying, that certain concepts are out of bounds when it comes to these discussion programs, you know, concepts like revolution or, class divide, class struggle, class consciousness, you know, they're concepts that just don't spring up. And that got me thinking about, you know, the way that language is used, you know, and you can avoid certain concepts by not invoking certain words. And of course, with the phrase the new normal, you know, that there's very loaded language there. It means the phrase the new normal means, you know, this is rubbish, put up with it, pretty much. And it sort of superseded that there was the previous slogan that was that came about not long after the 2008 economic crash, I think, you know, that keep calm and carry on. You know, a similar phrase that was out there. And, the typesetting of that poster, the keep calm and carry on one, was, it evoked, you know, the Blitz spirit. It was a sort of 1940s typeface. I think it was an original poster from the time. And, again, it's using that language, you know, this is rubbish, put up with it, but invoke the Blitz spirit, you know, we'll all get through this together. And they use all these buzzwords. You know, the pandemic's had dozens of them, you know, social distancing, social bubble, lockdown, flatten the curve, the R rate, you know, there's lots of jargon around. And obviously some of it's got a sort of a scientific origin, but it just got me thinking about how language is used to indoctrinate us, to shape what we think. And if you choose the right words and choose the right concepts, then you can shape opinion quite effectively. And that's one thing that this new normal slogan does, along with plenty of other examples. Thank you, that was just what popped into my head from what you were saying. Cheers, thanks.
Yes, I agree very much with what you've said there. It's something that's been ongoing for quite some time. Perhaps even the word ongoing is one of those words that have originated from management speak. I mentioned one or two of those in the introduction, but I had a whole list of them, which I decided to excise because I thought I might go on and on far too long. Something I've written down here: problems are no longer considered problems, they've morphed into challenges. And everything in my workplace is a challenge or an opportunity. And the opportunities are, of course, often linked with the challenges, and the challenges and opportunities ahead is one of the phrases. And then going forward is actually more sinister than annoying. It's actually originated, the only times I've ever seen it is in military speak, and it's in situations where perhaps someone falls out of a tank, is engulfed in flames, and the narrator says something to the effect, well, this person came tumbling out of the tank, he was in fire, but we could do nothing for him because we were still going forward. And going forward is just a phrase that means advancing towards the enemy lines. So I don't know where the management people got that, by some circuitous route from the military, whether consciously or just a word that they just like to sound of. But in your work, where you're often asked or told, actually, you're told to action things rather than just do them. We have actionables and also deliverables. So, yes, language is, it always reminds me of that management speak, reminds me of George Orwell's New Speak, as it was called in 1984, that if you can limit the vocabulary, you can limit the possible thoughts that people can have. And there definitely is some truth in that, whether your vocabulary is limited just by accident or whether it's done in a more deliberate fashion.
Right, thank you for that. Right, next is Paul. Paul Edwards. Thank you, Paul.
Cheers, Chair, and thanks, John. Yeah, it was absolutely spot on that. Thoroughly enjoyed that too. And I mean, there's certainly no doubt that you know, the importance of language and getting it right, kind of thing. I mean, I think half the time, if you were to put every single thing you said on a platter, you probably wouldn't have much to say, particularly when it comes to legal speak and such. Like, you know, I know that having a law degree, there are something like 4 recognised interpretations of just about every word and every term. And you know, it's why you need some of these legal brains to decipher them half the time it comes to toing and froing with some of these highfalutin barristers and such like. So, I mean, we cannot underestimate the importance of language and making ourselves understood. And yeah, so the new normal, I mean, it is, it's classic. It's a bit like the, you know, every bloody election that we get come round, particularly in America, just about everywhere, you know, you hear these one-liners about, you know, it's time for change, you know, we're going to change, you know, the rest of it. I think it's probably, and obviously only intended to give the regular mainstream electorate, you know, false hope that change really will come. The podcast thing, I'm a bit of a fan of podcasts too, for obvious reasons, including those that I get free on the Audible website. And there was one that I downloaded just a couple of weeks ago, and it had 8 separate podcasts built into this one. And the title of it was, or as I can't remember who the authors were, but 2 very interesting. They were 8 separate speeches or discussions that took place around what the title of it was Awkward Questions About Money. And it was, you know, it started off with the kind of basics, you know, flatmates, for example, falling out over money. You know, I think the example they gave was, you know, whose turn is it to pay for the dishwasher tablets and mundane things like that, and how do they overcome that? All the way through to sort of global capitalism. And with each passing episode in the series, it got more and more interesting. And there was, a bit like the example that you were giving, some really interesting comments and quite, you know, well-intentioned or, you know, comments that were made by people who maybe just needed a bit of fine-tuning. But they were certainly, you know, very critical of capitalism and articulated, you know, how bad it is and how much better the world could be, just stopping short of, you know, abolishing money altogether, you know. But as I say, it was called, and it's worth maybe checking out for them if it's available, or if you have Audible, if it's available elsewhere. It was, as I say, called Awkward Questions About Money. And it took you again through all the, you know, ideas of marital breakdown, relationship breakdowns, how, you know, unnecessarily complex the world is because of money and capitalism in general. So certainly worth checking that out. Yeah, and getting back to two of the other things, particularly Raymond was saying, you know, about contacting and Howard too. Every opportunity, I think we as members of the party should not be shy, you know, in coming forward when it comes to putting our thoughts and notions in. There's hardly, I try and make it my policy, if you like, my own personal inward policy to make contact with some of these platforms on a weekly basis, including the one that Howard mentioned and you discussed too, to try and put the party message across. The only thing is, again, it's the choice of language. As soon as you start appearing to come across from a political party or get overly political, they tend to sort of turn their back on you and you don't get very far. It's a bit like applying for some of these programs. You know, you're obliged to submit a question that you're likely to ask, and sometimes, you know, if you ask the wrong question, you've got absolutely no chance of getting on it. But again, it's very much down to the choice of language and how almost cunning and devious you have to be in order to get past these kind of gates, if you like, in order to get your message across. But listen, I'll call it a day. I've maybe made a bloody ton of things. If things dry up, I'll maybe come back to you a wee bit later on with some more suggestions. But for now, I'll leave it at that. Thanks again, John. It was very interesting. Good man. Cheers.
Right, yes, that was quite interesting. There was something I was going to say there, but I've now forgotten what it was. It was just further to one of the points you raised, but it might come back to me as the meeting progresses.
Right, next is Debbie. Debbie,
hi, I just wanted to talk about the Spanish flu. Well, it was misnamed the Spanish flu. It probably started in America or China, and it happened because bats infected pigs and then pigs infected human beings. But it actually killed between 50 and 100 million people in the world. And it didn't discriminate with age. And one of the things people know is about pandemics. You stay away from sick people or whatever, or people who are infected, right? You know, and that's true of the coronavirus as well, right? You know. But I mean, coronavirus is nothing like the Spanish flu. It's probably going to kill 2-3 million in the world, whereas the Spanish flu killed between 50 and 100 million. And the doctor that blew the whistle on coronavirus, Chinese doctor, he died of coronavirus treating people. So, but I mean, the Spanish flu was interesting, really. You know, they didn't really understand viruses at the time. All they had was aspirins, and some countries didn't even have that to treat the flu. And it was a terrible thing. But I mean, the birth rate in some countries went up, and it happens after wars sometimes, but it also happened after the Spanish flu. There was quite an increase in the birth rate in some countries and things. That's all I wanted to say, right?
Yeah, I think after a disaster such as that, you would need an increase in the birth rate just to try and partly compensate for all the people that were lost. I think they say it was the largest single the very worst known case of influenza throughout the world. It went everywhere in the world. There was no part of the world that was left untouched. And as for it being the Spanish flu, I think it was just because in the initial stages it seemed to affect Spain particularly badly, and because that was quite noticeable, I think it was called the Spanish flu.
It wasn't that reason. It was because it had actually happened in America and China and India and places much earlier than Spain, but because Europe was at war, they called it the Spanish flu because it was recognised in Spain. They didn't even acknowledge it in Britain or other countries that were at war. It didn't take hold in Spain till after other places were.
Ah, right. That's interesting to know. I had heard about it taking hold in American military camps in particular because of the vast movements of troops and so on, but I hadn't delved all that deeply into it, except to notice that it was very, very devastating indeed, with all these millions of people dying.
Next is Paddy. Hello there, Paddy.
Hi. I was going to say something similar, that Spain was the only country producing statistics on the Spanish flu, because the other countries were keeping it all secret. But I think that point's been made. Just a couple of other interesting things that occurred to me was you mentioned the Black Death and how conditions for workers, economic conditions improved after the Black Death, sort of kind of obviously supply and demand. I also happen to remember that for anybody who's even remotely interested, this was the reason why the architecture of cathedrals changed at this time, from the very ornate decorative Gothic to the very simple straight line perpendicular. And the main reason for that wasn't an artistic revolution. It was just that they couldn't get the bloody masons, and getting workers to sort of clock on and clock off was notoriously difficult, as they were all a bunch of bolshy bastards after the plague. So there we go. That affected architecture. But on a separate point, I was looking at an animated map the other day, we can find this stuff online, of the global spread of the pandemic and the spread within each country. And what's really, really abundantly obvious immediately is that the pandemic spreads, not all that surprisingly, from transport hubs, and it radiates outwards from transport hubs in sort of pretty much concentric circles until one thread gets to another transport hub, and then the same thing happens there. And this happens within countries and all across the world. And when I was looking at this map, I was thinking, well, it's screamingly obvious what needed to be done. The transport hubs needed to be shut down and all travel stopped across the world. And that would have stopped it in its tracks. And then I thought, but this can't happen in capitalism because of the globalised nature of trade and the free movement of people. It's impossible to do it in capitalism, which then led me to the speculation, how would we do it in socialism if we don't... if we had the same sort of globalised distribution that we do in capitalism, which presupposes, a question we asked about the other day, industrialism, at what level of industrialism would be centralised and globalised. If we had that kind of global distribution, we would also find it very difficult to shut down a pandemic like this. However, if production was mostly localised, and to the greatest extent possible, various regions aimed at self-sufficiency, then most of the travel, most of the distribution would be across the world, would probably be, you could probably stop it. You could probably shut everything down and stop the transmission of a pandemic virus like this. You can't do it in capitalism. I mean, just looking at the map, it's blatantly obvious that you can't bring that to bear, because you'd have to stop capitalism. But I don't know, it's a speculation, but if socialism was much more localised, then it would be much easier to deal with a situation like this. OK, anyway, that's me.
Yes, I think socialism definitely will facilitate more localised production. It just the way capitalism works, because of its peculiar economic requirements, is just quite insane, sending stuff all over the world, crisscrossing all over the planet, to no real proper purpose in terms of meeting people's needs. Most things, by the time we have socialism, and even now, could probably be just as well produced anywhere in the world. And as for those things that did need to crisscross the planet, then we would have to think about measures to limit those. If we were subjected to another such pandemic.
Right. Thanks for that, Paddy, and your response, John.